Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. I am, of course, reporting from the festivities in Las Vegas this week, which is why my voice is completely ruined. Sorry about that. So far, I have been to Black Hat and B-Sides, and when I put the show to bed, I will be heading on down to DEF CON to take a look at that. And hey, you know, I haven't been able to meet up with as many listeners as I would have liked to because I've been absolutely slammed since I got here. I've been, I haven't been to one talk. I went to one talk the whole time I've been here. A few of you reached out and haven't been able to organize anything, and I am sorry about that, but it has been crazy. So I'm going to try to tweet out a location for a meetup on Saturday afternoon at DEF CON or somewhere nearby. But I'm guessing most of you who are here are going to hear this on the way out of Vegas. So I'll just be tweeting that. I think if I do come back to Las Vegas again, I will organize a proper event for listeners because it was pretty dumb of me to think I could catch up with people ad hoc. Sorry about that. But anyway, on to this week's show. And this week we're hearing from Wired.com's Andy Greenberg and Trail of Bits' very own Dan Guido in the news segment. Then in this week's feature, we'll be hearing from Zane Lackey, a co-founder of Signal Sciences. They're a defensive startup, but Zane has a history in both defense and offense. And, this is becoming a real trend. Hackers are building stuff these days. The breakers are building. Does that mean defense is the new sexy and dropping bugs is just kind of passé? Zane joins us to talk about that. This week's show is brought to you by Rapid7, and as you know, Rapid7 is a security software firm with a fairly broad product set. And we'll be chatting with Rapid7's very own Wade Woolwine about trends in a booming software category. Some people call it EDR, Endpoint Detection and Response. Others call it IDR, Incident Detection and Response. And you know what? It's just gone crazy here in Vegas. I mean, Black Hat is increasingly like RSA, and just everyone on the trade floor has EDR. So it's like, you know, even the Las Vegas hobos lying under trees on the street are selling EDR. So we'll be speaking with Wade about what's driving the demand for this type of software and what some of the pitfalls can be. But let's kick things off now with a news segment. I spoke with Wired.com's Andy Greenberg about a series of reports he's written on car hacking. That's a real theme here at Black Hat. And then I moved on to chat with Dan Guido about the rest of the news. And unfortunately, we recorded this before Apple announced its bug bounty program, but we'll be discussing that, of course, in next week's show with Adam Boileau. But here's the news segment now with Andy Greenberg and Dan Guido. I hope you enjoy it. All right, Andy, here we are in the press center at Black Hat. And, you know, what we were just saying before I flipped on the microphone, we've got three stories in front of us here about car hacking. And, you were asking me, do we want to focus on each story? And, you know, like I said to you, I think it's more that I want to talk to you about the fact that there are three stories in the same week at a conference, you know, centering around a conference like Black Hat.
And I think that these are, in fact, just like the three most exciting stories. There are tons of other car hacking talks, mostly about car hacking tools that people have developed that I didn't bother to cover. But I think there's like maybe four or five of those talks as well. So it's definitely like, it's one of the big themes of Black Hat and DEF CON this year.
And that took me completely by surprise. I mean, it was novelty research when it started off a couple of years ago. Of course, your whole thing with the video of you in the Jeep and it being killed and stuff, that really put it on the agenda. But the extent to which this has become a major issue has shocked me. And I guess, the Tesla autopilot failure as well, the alleged Tesla autopilot failure has certainly put this in the public's consciousness, hasn't it?
Definitely. And I mean, it's interesting that this team of researchers have come out, we just broke the story yesterday of the fact that they have been working on ways to spoof and jam Tesla's autopilot, because they were working on that long before, months and months before that accident in May that led to the death of a man in Florida. So, that was clearly on their minds already, and probably because of, like, the last year's massive summer of car hacking.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the radar stuff, too, and Dan and I were just discussing that about how radar, there's a lot of people doing some funky stuff with software-defined radio, and you wonder how that's going to interact with things like, radar-assisted cruise control and auto-driving features and stuff. But, Dan, I want to ask you, too, because the extent to which this has become an issue, Casey Ellis and I are pretty good mates, and he was telling me that he went to some auto conference in Detroit where they're expecting a couple of hundred people, and the whole thing was just rammed. There seems to be so much interest from the car manufacturers themselves. And that's also surprising, don't you think?
It's been an incredible turn of events to see people at the executive level at all the car manufacturers in the United States that have kind of really understood and went by this gospel now that they have seen the light. I think that bug bounties are probably helping change a lot of that culture, and Casey's been working behind the scenes with many of those people. But I also wonder if many of these strategies are the right ones. It doesn't seem like there's tons of interest in doing formal verification of software that's running on these chips. And I wonder if that's a missed opportunity.
Well, I think it's partially because SEL4, which is the only verified kernel, it's pretty much useful for running a calculator and not much else, right?
Sure. I mean, there's different parts of the software that you can verify. You don't have to go all the way to the kernel. You can start at the apps. And there's readily available tools to do it. I think at least there's one working example where you've got the European airline industry and Airbus in particular that really aggressively uses these tools to eliminate the possibility of certain types of flaws in their systems. And it's a strategy that I'd love to see our car manufacturers get behind.
Now, obviously, Andy, you've kind of owned this beat since it became a thing. I mean, you helped create this beat.
For better or for worse.
This is the first time I can think about seeing an entire industry actually respond. As you say, you might not think they're doing necessarily the right things, but there's definitely been a response, and there's definitely interest at an executive level. I'm struggling to think of when we've seen an industry vertical do that before. This feels like the first time.
Yeah, it's really good news to hear that you're seeing that. The car companies don't like to talk to me very much. But I sometimes wonder, like, am I overplaying this? Because we haven't seen many real-world car hacks at all. So, but at the same time, there are these signs that the industry is responding, which was the intention in the first place. And Chrysler's bug bounty with Bug Crowd was a really heartening piece of news. In general, it does feel like the auto industry may be getting ahead of this pretty dangerous problem, which is rare and very nice to hear.
Although there was a bit of back and forth between Charlie and Chris when they reported an issue, and FCA basically said, well, you kind of have to be in the car to make this an issue. So we don't really see this as being a safety issue beyond other things like, if you've got access to the car, cut the brake lines, things like that. So do you think there's going to be a bit of argy-bargy? Because I kind of see that on the cards in the next 6 months as people begin to report issues.
My impression, you can talk to Charlie and Chris, but my impression is that Chrysler's been pretty friendly with them and really listened to them. But it's when they kind of put out their public response that they downplay these things, that they,
Well, it's funny that security people are surprised by that, but as journalists, I guess we're a little more used to that, right?
Yeah, when I tell Charlie and Chris what Chrysler's response statement is, they're usually kind of surprised and sometimes I think a little disappointed. But I get the impression that Chrysler is pretty responsive. I mean, they did develop a patch and in response to their work last year, although they then, in this sort of fear of the public ripple effect, they released it in the quietest possible way, which was a real problem. And that's really what led to the recall, is that they had failed to publicize the patch.
Yeah. So, look, specifically your stories, there was the Tesla one. There's also Chris and Charlie's latest Jeep work. But there's one here also affecting big rigs, trucks. And this one looks pretty bad.
Yeah, I would say that's actually the scariest of the three. I mean, again, this was like a physical access CAN bus hack. This was a physical access attack on a vehicle. But it was using an open standard. These were researchers at the University of Michigan. They're really young. One of them was an undergraduate, and it took them 2 months of just like a little bit of reverse engineering, but mostly just reading the specs and using this open standard to find simple attacks that allowed them to control the acceleration and even disable one kind of the brakes of this truck, which is a 33,000 pounds tractor trailer. I mean, that is like somewhat terrifying. And these vehicles not only have open standards, but they are arguably more often connected to the internet than consumer vehicles.
Well, and another thing, right, that I don't think has been fully discussed is, okay, sure, you don't have remote access to the OBD2 port, but a lot of insurance companies, especially in the United States, they have these little OBD2 connectors that sync up with your iPhone, do you know what I mean, and provide data to the insurance companies. You've also got fleet management, which is networked, which plugs into those ports. Also, I think it's a matter of time before someone actually develops a Dropbox-style OBD2 thing that has cellular access back to an attacker, so it's like a Dropbox for a vehicle. That feels to me like it'll be the next phase, and that kind of invalidates the arguments from groups like FCA about, hey, oh, it's you need to be in the car, because once that happens, you don't need to be in the car.
That's right. I mean, last year we saw an actual attack on one of those OBD dongles, the insurance dongles you're talking about, where they connected to it over the internet. It had shitty security, and these University of California San Diego researchers disabled the brakes of a Corvette using that little OBD device, that insurance dongle, you know. And trucks, thousands of industrial trucks have those same systems, and they use them for telematics or fleet management or whatever they want to call it. And just a few months ago, there was another researcher, I think you covered on the show, who found that thousands of those same telematics dongles were really vulnerable. So that, you know, you put these two things together and you have a massive semi-trailer, big rig truck that is like accelerating out of control under the control of a hacker, which is just like, you know, diehard.
The future is
material.
Awesome, right? Like, yeah, the future is awesome.
Yeah.
All right, Andy Greenberg, thank you very much for joining us to have a bit of a chat about that. We're going to move on to the rest of the news now with Dan Guido. So again, thank you. It's great to see you here.
Thanks,
in Vegas.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. Dan, I just want to get stuck into, we're going to get stuck into the rest of the news now. And Project Zero have been making friends and influencing people over the last couple of weeks. Tavis Ormandy has been really ripping into LastPass and 1Password. And this is, you know, on one hand, this is great, right? Because they're finding bugs that absolutely shouldn't be in security products. But at the same time, I'm worried that they're not really contextualizing their research output. And the message a lot of people seem to be getting is, I shouldn't use, you know, password managers, which seems like really shitty advice. And I'm just wondering what your take is on this, because I just think, well, if your goal is to increase, is to improve security and move the needle in the right direction, I'm just wondering if these types of offensive capers are still the way to go.
Yeah, I certainly feel that. I think of the LastPass case, it was a little bit more egregious and maybe worth making some noise about it, because for years now, I've been saying that it's really obvious that they're mixing control and they're mixing data in the way that they inject their login into a website. And it's not an architecture decision they wanted to revisit or review. So it kind of takes some extraordinarily offensive action sometimes to get these vendors to change behavior. However, definitely in this case, I do agree with you as well that, pumping out information that, like, look, password managers are all unsafe and you should be risky, you should be paying attention to your personal risk when you use them, sends a really conflicting message to a lot of people that don't understand the technology themselves.
And, you know, look, in much the same vein, actually, it's funny, because we know we're at Black Hat when Dave Litchfield is on stage dropping a whole bunch of horrible, horrible, horrible Oracle bugs, and he's done that again. Like, he's been having a go at Oracle's e-business suite. It's interesting, though, right, because he's been doing this for over a decade, and yet Oracle still sucks, and they're still having money fights in the office. So, I mean, this kind of tells us that, I think offense has worked against some organizations. It seems to be working in the auto industry. It seemed to really work against Microsoft. Some people, though, they don't get the message and they never will, right? So I think this is this has been the first year that I've really started questioning the role of offense and thinking that maybe we need to get a little bit more nuanced than just bug dropping.
So I think this is the clearest example yet, that unless you start from the top, unless the culture change comes from executives in charge of the company, that there's really nothing that you can do to improve security culture inside of an organization. With the auto manufacturers, it's clear that they get it. They even stood up an automotive ISAC and published best practices and principles that will guide the behavior of every single person that's part of it. And that kind of, from the top effort hasn't shown up in Oracle. So I will be looking forward to the next 100 bugs that come out next month, because I don't think it's really ever going to end until you see that kind of behavior shift.
And, Dave Litchfield's a friend of mine, right? And I kind of get where he's coming from, which is like, I'm just going to keep standing here and yelling and yelling and yelling. And do you know what I mean? And I get why he does it. I really get why he does it. But, does it move the needle forward? In the Oracle's case, it just seems like it doesn't, right?
Yeah, this strategy has clearly not worked with them. You got to probably try something else to get them to change behavior. This is just one of many strategies that security professionals can take to improve the security of products that people use.
We've also seen some chip and pin research pop up at Black Hat. What I love about this is that Australia, of course, moved to chip and pin many, many years ago. So it's kind of funny watching the same types of talks pop up in the United States now. But there is some novel work. But what I like about this research is that it's not game over for chip and pin. No one's really completely broken it. There's problems with implementations, people putting the wrong type of data on the wrong part of the chip. You know what I mean? And that's everywhere. But we haven't really seen the killer blow for smart cards, like in the same way that we have against, Magstripe, for example, right?
I think the U.S. community is starting to warm up to these kinds of protocols and these kinds of systems, because this is our first real exposure to it since, all of us got mailed our new cards. And the kinds of issues that people are finding are those really low-level implementation issues, the kind of things that you scratch your head and ask, like, why didn't PCI certification find this? Like,
and how did a banking team let this go out, right?
Yeah, it's really basic hygienic stuff, like, oh, you're not using TLS on a network on your network traffic. Like, really? Like, that's a checkbox kind of security measure. You should really be doing that.
Yeah. Oh, now Yahoo is apparently investigating reports that 200 million of its user accounts are for sale on the dark web. I mean, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens now that, you know, Yahoo's core business is going to be folded into Verizon to see if things actually get better. But we're going to kind of miss them as a whipping boy, I think, because they have been our whipping boy for many years.
Well, you're missing the best part of this, because the 200 million accounts are being sold for $3,000. So it's
right.
Like just another kick in the teeth.
Yeah, it's another like, oh my God, not our user data is even worthless, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, no. I mean, I think at least in this case, a lot of that information may not have come from a recent leak or a property that Yahoo even owns. Yeah, it's really easy for people in the underground to take password databases that got released and then kind of test to see if they work on other platforms, then re-release them as a new release, because maybe like you got data from the Tumblr accounts, but then you tried them on Yahoo, and now you've got a big Yahoo database, and you can rebrand it, resell it, and it looks novel.
It seems like a lot of work for $3,000, to be honest, right? There's a report here on Ars Technica that claims that more than half of UK firms have been hit by ransomware. I mean, look, you know, whether or not you believe these reports, which are often, you know, vendor-driven, doesn't really matter. The point is that it's a... It's interesting to me that we're standing here at Black Hat talking about car hacking and OBD2 ports and things like that when, you know, average enterprises, which is what this community is supposed to serve, they're getting hosed by this stuff, right?
Yeah, we forget about security being not always about, you know, buffer overflow, advanced versions. Sometimes there are real issues that affect real people that are really boring, and this is definitely one of them. And like you mentioned, this is probably, you know, an example of the kind of vendor garbage that I really don't like, but then you dig into the details of how they found this data, and it's pretty reasonable. They just called up and interviewed a couple thousand firms in the UK and around the world to see what they thought and whether they'd experienced these issues, and overwhelmingly, people are affected by ransomware. It's just a surprising number, sometimes unbelievable, but it's true.
Ars Technica also reports, and this story is a killer story, apparently the FBI might have been aware of the intrusion into the DNC's network as far back as like mid-2015. And apparently they got in touch with DNC and said, you know, the DNC and said, hey, you know, you guys might want to check some stuff out, but didn't really give them any actionable information. And I can understand this is a common problem in these scenarios. When they're dealing perhaps with some classified information, they can't declassify it to give it to the DNC. So they just sort of hint, they vaguely hint, maybe you should check your logs. And of course, that's not enough information, is it?
I mean, look, if an FBI secret agent comes to you and says, hey, man, you know, I don't know, like, if you've looked at your logs lately, but maybe you should, I would really try and listen to them a little bit harder than what the DNC probably did at first.
But, I mean, they didn't come in and say, call Mandiant, roll IR. They came in and said, want to just, you know, have a little look at the old seam in the corner sort of thing.
At the same time, I mean, it's a political campaign for a major election in the United States, and you have to kind of, like, it's not really surprising to me that other countries would be interested in the outcome or the operations of the DNC campaign. So it's kind of like, if you didn't prepare for this already, like, how much am I going to be able to change the current state that you're in?
Well, I guess that's the thing, too. It's kind of like every day on the internet, these sorts of intelligence gathering operations. I think what really changed the equation, I mean, had the FBI known that they were going to, like, dox the DNC via WikiLeaks, you know what I mean? They might have worked a little harder to declassify that stuff. So, but an interesting story nonetheless. Also from Ars, this is cool, right? This is like using metadata, basically like examining packet sizes and stuff to infer private information from HTTPS connections. I think this is... I've seen little talks. I saw one at RuxCon years ago where a guy was doing a presentation on inferring where people were looking on Google Maps just by looking at packet sizes, right? So this seems like a similar thing, but you can do stuff like dig out SSNs and email addresses and small chunks of text. It's cool research.
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of the SSL attacks right now are abusing things like side channels to capture data that's encrypted inside. And it's kind of separate from a lot of the research activity and the improvements that are being done to OpenSSL, where they're focused on functional verification. They're focused on ensuring the ciphers work the way that they're supposed to. And don't have functional bugs. But these side channel vulnerabilities, there's a huge number of research publications related to them, and people haven't really gotten a hold of what they should do yet. So I'm looking forward to further developments on the defensive side for that kind of research.
Moving to the world's biggest bug bounty, Bitcoin. And another exchange has been hit, this time for, $77 million, which has caused a 20% value hit in Bitcoin, which is no surprise. I mean, this is just like every day of the week. But there, look, this has shades of the Ethereum shenanigans, because the person who did this is doing some, like, you know, Olympic grade. I mean, this should be in the Rio Olympics. It's Olympic grade trolling.
Yeah. So what we've seen is that one of the guys that claimed to have performed this hack posted on Reddit and offered 1,000 bitcoins to a random commentator in the thread, just to, you know, give away some of the stolen material that he got. So
it's, and what's that worth?
That's about $5 million worth of Bitcoin. So it's not an insubstantial sum. So this is kind of the most novel part, that it seems like the Ethereum hacker has started a trend of these people giving away part of their earnings back to the public.
So. But trolling cryptocurrency people is like, it's not hard.
No.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not, because there's all of these. What I find interesting about cryptocurrency, it's the most interesting thing for me, is there's a whole political ideology wrapped around it. Do you know what I mean? And people really believe in it.
Yeah.
So they're so easy to f*** with.
Well, man, you get no regulation, and this is what happens. So,
indeed.
Welcome to the future.
Now, I think it was last week or the week before that we reported on the show via some other news service that NIST had pushed out some guidelines recommending that people don't use SMS two-factor authentication anymore. Krebs on Security reported on August 1 that the Social Security Administration in the United States now requires two-factor authentication. Guess what they're using? This is just hilarious, like, hilarious.
Yep, they're using SMS. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, it's a step forward. It's not, it's not worse than what we currently have. I actually feel that for the Social Security Administration, way too many people try and believe that these things are private information that you can use for authentication purposes. I think they should just publish every single person's Social Security number on a website somewhere that you can go download easily.
And force people to find other authentication mechanisms. You know, someone floated that idea, because we had this conversation before, and I didn't remember at the time, and it just came to me now, that I remember someone quite prominent floated that idea like 10 years ago, and everyone just said, that's insane. You know what I mean? And now, here we are in 2016, it kind of seems reasonable. So, yeah. But yeah, it's still funny that they're rolling with SMS like just immediately after that recommendation, and you can just imagine some bureaucrat sitting there going, oh, thanks, NIST.
Yep, absolutely.
Lorenzo over at Vice, who we caught up with earlier, actually, he has a few stories over at Motherboard. One of them is one of the administrators of one of these dark web forums, he's just disappeared, right? And it's interesting because you're just never going to know why. Did the FBI scoop him up? Did he get hit by a bus? Is he getting chemo? Like, what's happened to this guy?
This is one of these cases where somebody could have just caught up on the Grux Twitter and, like, read through one of his OPSEC guides and been like, oh, no, I forgot to do this thing. They're coming after me. I got to burn all my stuff. So, you know, you have no idea. And a lot of these people, you know, are plants. A lot of these people are informants. So sometimes people just get a little bit of a sense of risk and drop everything they've got and run away.
And other people who should do that don't, and they wind up in prison.
Yes. Yes, they do.
Yeah, we've also got an interesting story, again from Motherboard, but this is one by Joseph Cox, which, and I've heard a little bit about this, someone told me about it the other night. Some privacy activists have launched a database. It's like an open source database to track surveillance tech, right? Who sells what to who? Which is kind of an interesting idea, but I don't think the information, even if it's point in time accurate at the time that they launch it, I can't see it staying accurate for very long, simply because the companies that make this stuff can't correct the information. Do you know what I mean? So I like the idea, but I'm just not sure that it's gonna work and achieve what they want it to.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult to collect reliable information about these firms. I gotta give them props for trying and for putting together some actual concrete data, because there is a lot of talk about this issue with very little substance from many other firms, from other nonprofits and political activist groups.
Some transparency would be nice, right? But again, like, you know, because their aim is to increase awareness, even if the data is inaccurate, it doesn't get corrected. I just worry that we could wind up with an inaccurate view.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, on one hand, I am worried that, you know, this does incentivize people to just get out their pitchforks and to topple over, you know, company after company based on some activities that they do. Without you know, accurate view as to what that really was, just based on an out-of-context marketing document that they may have encountered.
Now, here's a fun one to end with, which is the idea of people mounting attack platforms onto drones and flying them around SCADA networks, which are often using hideous, insecure radio protocols and unsecured Wi-Fi and stuff like that. So you see the headline and you think, man, that's really stupid, until you actually think about it a little bit and you're like, yeah, you can pretty much mount an attack platform to a very cheap, low-cost drone, fly it into a, you know, ICS plant or whatever and do horrible things. So it's one of those scary future headlines that's usually you think is overblown, but this kind of makes a bit of scary sense, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's been plenty of little projects where people have mounted little Wi-Fi hacking robots on top of Roombas and, like, driven them around to try and find open Wi-Fi networks, and this is just the same thing with wings. You know, it's pretty straightforward.
With blades.
Blades, yes. Yeah, so these things are really democratizing the availability of surveillance and hacking technology to, you know, lower cost levels. A lot of people are really concerned with the surveillance and, like, aggregation of data among corporate and government people, but, you know, things like cheap Android phones and cheap drone platforms make it really easy for individuals to mount attacks that really were only in the realm of much more higher resourced individuals in the past, or corporations or governments in the past, and that's kind of what's scary. I think there's a power shift that's going back to the individual that people aren't really paying attention to, and it's based on stuff like drones.
All right, Dan Guido, thank you very much for finding the time somehow at Black Hat to come here and talk about the news with me this week. Hopefully you and I can actually have a nice cold beer after I put the show to bed. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot, Patrick.
That was Andy Greenberg from Wired and Dan Guido from Trailer Bits there. Big thanks to them. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Zane Lackey, who is the co-founder and CSO of a company called Signal Sciences. And like a growing number of security software company founders, Zane has a history in offensive security as well as defensive work. And this is, you know, it's a real trend. Hackers are starting to build things. Zane worked for ISEC Partners as a security consultant, and he also served as Etsy's director of security engineering. So he spent some time on both sides of the fence. Now, this is such a trend. These, you know, hackers actually starting these companies. It's such a trend that I'm personally finding myself less and less interested in offensive research and talks. So when I started covering this industry, it was bug research that drove change. That was a really big driver of change. But increasingly it feels like, we heard a bit of that in the news there. But increasingly it feels like fresh approaches to defensive technology are what's really pushing things forward. So things really have changed in that sense. So I spoke to Zane at Black Hat about, offensive people doing defensive things, and here's what he had to say. And a language warning on this one: I say shit in this interview a lot. Here's Zane.
For those of us kind of starting out in this field, you know, 15, 20 years ago, it was like you only saw really focus on a lot of offensive work. And now seeing that balance, and especially when you see somebody who has a background on one side going and working on the other side, I think it's fascinating. I think some of the best work you see is because of that, because they have a deep understanding and appreciation of the other side of the fence, right? And I think this is a trend that I've been really excited to see, of especially offensive folks coming to the defensive side and understanding that. And the defensive folks also going to an offensive side, whether that's, you know, security consulting or pen testing or whatever there.
Well, one thing that I've noticed, and I started looking into this and realizing it was a real thing when I did a listener survey a while ago and discovered that, like, I think it was like 15% of my audience are developers, right? And this is new. This is a relatively new thing. And I think what's happened is a lot of these guys have been forced to go get training or forced to think about it. And I was chatting with a guy today, actually. He's an interesting guy. And he's like, yeah, the developers I used to speak to were like, you're paranoid, you know, everything's fine. And like, stop telling us what to do. Whereas now, you know, say you take 100 developers and expose them to security concepts, 15 of them are going to get absolutely hooked, right? So are you noticing that as well? A lot of developers, there's a lot of security conscious developers out there?
Absolutely. I think the buy-in is really increased. I think whenever I meet developers here at Black Hat or any other conference, that's some of the stuff that makes me the most happy, is seeing the increase of other fields of engineering being here, because it's no longer security as the other that's always, you know, saying no or inhibiting and getting in the way. It's a broader understanding of the field by the folks that it impacts the most. And so even just personally, I've really tried to, over the last couple of years, give many more talks at developer and CTO sort of conferences than even security conferences.
You know, I mean, this is a famously pessimistic industry that I've been covering for 15 years now, right? For the first time, I kind of feel like it feels like the needle might be moving in the right direction. I mean, there's a long way to go, but it hasn't felt like we've had forward momentum before. I mean, do you get that feeling as well?
Absolutely. And Alex Damos, I think, said this way better than I ever could. He termed, kind of coined the term around like security nihilism, right? Which is that, you know, for plenty of security folks, especially in the past, it was always, well, if this can't be perfect, we can't do anything. And I just really fundamentally reject that. I think that moving the needle forward, like making things better, even, you know, the sacrificing the good at the expense of the perfect, right? I think it's crazy. I think we really have an obligation to try to make things better. And it's fantastic to see that across the industry, really people pushing things forward on the defensive side.
Now, we used to think, and for a long time, I believe that it was true, right? We used to think that offensive research forcing people to actually patch bugs, because, you know, newcomers to the industry might not realize that it used to be difficult to get vendors to even fix things, let alone in a timely manner, right? So offensive research really did move the needle in the right direction, solved a lot of problems. I wonder if it's becoming, well, not redundant, because it's definitely still valuable, but there are certainly a lot of people who still put undue focus on it. Do you think that's true? Because it's still like a culture thing. I kind of feel like there's a lot of really good researchers out there who don't quite realize that maybe they're not moving the needle forward as far as they think. I'm trying to be tactful. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Absolutely. I don't think that the rise of one necessarily has to come at the expense of the other, right? The rise of really interesting defensive research and defensive teams doing a really great job out there, it doesn't have to come at the expense of offense. I think that what's personally really rewarding to me, I think, is seeing, especially because I started out on the offensive side and went over to the defensive. So just personally, it's been great to see the rise of defense here as well, and seeing both in conference talks and research and tools and presentations, like seeing that rise, and that the complement of the two is, I think, where we need to go.
Okay, sure. But, I mean, specifically, right? Let me cite a specific example. Tavis Ormandy has been ripping LastPass a new one. The problem, as I see it, is people will then come and ask people like myself, who are a sort of bridge between normal people and, you know, the security industry. That wasn't supposed to come off as offensive as it sounded, but I think people will know what I mean. And they ask me, hey, you know, I'm seeing all these headlines, because journalists, right, they're all chasing eyeballs, right? The reason I got into audio, it's not an accident. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to have to write link bait headlines. But they will. They'll write the link bait headlines about how vulnerable password managers and stuff are. And the average reader, what they take away from that is, don't use password managers. So here we've got one of the world's, you know, indisputably most talented offensive researchers sending a signal that people shouldn't use a tool that is a net positive to their security. So that bothers me. Does it bother you as well? Because it's starting to feel like that attitude of just shitting on everything, it's wearing a little bit thin, for me, at least.
I think what's important there, right, we've seen this throughout the history of this industry, of offensive research being published in a variety of ways, and sometimes with context and sometimes without context. And I think what's just important there is trying to give context of the broader picture that, you know, even though things have individual bugs, it might not mean that security control in and of itself is something that you should, you know, throw out the baby with the bathwater.
But researchers, and I'm not just talking about Tavis here, researchers seem these days to be genuinely unwilling or unable to provide any sort of context around their findings. Do you know what I mean? You really have to dive in, because, you see the headline, oh, there's this bug, right? What they don't tell you is that it's mitigated at some other control level in an OS, if it's an iOS bug or something like that. So actually understanding the impact, the context, the likely, you know, risk introduced by these bugs, it's very, very hard. And I just wonder if are these guys actually still moving the needle forward? You know, I mean, the work is valuable, but if it's released without context, does it actually do anything positive for us?
I want to believe that anybody who's publishing bugs, right, I think really believes in their heart that they're trying to help, and that they're trying to help secure, you know, not just the most technical few, but the broader set of folks, right, our families, our friends, and trying to really help secure them. And I think, you know, the industry has come a long way, I feel like, at least during my time in it, and I think we've still got a long way to go. But I certainly agree that the more context that you can give, the better, and, you know, in kind of the larger picture there. But I think we've come a long way, and we've got a long way to go.
Do you think one of the issues is because we've come from an industry where the defensive tech has traditionally been so utterly f***ing horrible, right? And it has been legitimately shit. It seems like just in the last 5 years or so, we've started to see, you know, little solutions around the edge. I mean, you guys are a good example of that, right? It's WebAppSec stuff, solves a very specific problem. you know, Canary's another one. Duo, very specific problem, but they've solved it, right? Because RSA, you know, their stuff was great in like 1985 or whenever they developed it, right? So Duo's come along and actually done a meaningful, you know, 2FA play. But it seems, you know, because we spent so long as an industry dealing with shit operating systems, shit control software, shit detection software, that we have an automatic, like, reflex reaction to just shit all over any defensive tech. I mean, do you think that's a part of it? Because now that I'm saying it out loud, it certainly feels that way to me.
I think one of the things that's been most fascinating to watch on defensive tech is this generation of products that has come out by people who have actually been there on both sides of the problem, that have skills on the offensive side, that have skills on the defensive side. And the products that tend to excite me personally the most are the ones that somebody built because they had to solve a problem, right? They didn't set out to just become a vendor or something like that. Like, they had to solve a problem themselves. And the more they talked to their peers, the more they saw everyone else was having this problem, and the more they wanted to help a broader set of people.
I'm guessing we just heard a chapter from your diary with that one, right? But can you think of can you name check some other vendors who you're watching that you know, who are putting out some technology you respect?
I mean, you stole some of my favorite ones right there already. Attack IQ out of San Diego. The full disclosure is I actually invested in those guys because I was really excited about them. And some others that are kind of emerging out of whatever we want to call stealth mode now these days. But over time here, I think that there are, I've been watching this trend of practitioners going and starting companies around that. And I think it pushes the industry forward in a way that it needs to be pushed forward.
I agree entirely. Zane Lackey, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
That was Zane Lackey of Signal Sciences there. Big thanks to him. As I mentioned earlier, this week's show is sponsored by Rapid7. Big thanks to them. Rapid7 makes a stack of useful products. I mean, they do your vulnerability scanning stuff. They've got User Insight, which is very cool software. They're doing, and they're doing a lot of IDR stuff as well. They're pushing into the IDR or EDR space. So this week we're chatting with Wade Woolwine, who heads up breach detection and response services for Rapid7. And we're chatting to him about EDR. I think they call it IDR. That's their preferred term. But yeah, it's all the same idea. It's host-based incident detection software that actually has a response and forensics capability. And this is a booming product category. So I wanted to get Wade's thoughts on what's driving the demand for EDR. So I started off by asking him if it's more the response side than the actual detection side that's driving demand. And here's what he had to say.
You can't just play whack-a-mole anymore. You can't just say, oh, I identified this piece of malware, I'm going to pave and replace the box. Because in most attacks that we investigate nowadays, there are 3 or 4 different implants. And potentially, if you are one of the unlucky organizations that still uses single factor for your remote access, the attacker is actually coming in right through your front door and flying below the radar because you are not equipped to be able to monitor that behavior that's coming from outside.
So how does IDR help in a case like that? When you've got, when there's been a compromise, they've dumped some creds and they're coming in through legit access, where is an IDR platform going to help you with that?
So that's where we're going to be looking at, so for that specific use case, that's where we're going to be looking at geographic-based connectivity, right? So if you have your user, John Smith, who usually connects from Reston, Virginia, because that's where your office is or that's where he lives, and then all of a sudden you have John Smith logging in from California or Canada or even worse, China, you know that there's something amiss there, and that's something that you need to investigate. Further, one of the concepts that we encourage customers to look into as they're building their own capability or even as they're engaging us to help them is to actually look at the behavior post-logon. So John Smith, when he logs in via VPN, is going to check his email first, maybe do some instant messaging, and maybe connect to the finance file share because he is a financial person, whereby an attacker logging in as John Smith would not follow that same behavior. They're not going to check their email first thing. They're probably going to launch ping, a couple of other commands like whois and ipconfig so that they understand where they've landed. So the behavior post-login is going to be vastly different from your normal user and your impersonated user.
So you're doing that in your IDR stuff as well as in packages like User Insight, which is, I got to say, pretty good software, that User Insight stuff. So is that, you're applying some of the same thinking, but doing it on the host. Is that the idea or?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of melding two or three different methodologies, right? So a network threat analyst would be very focused on the GeoIP and the net flow. An event log analyst would be very interested in logons and specifically logon times, whereby someone on the endpoint would be very interested in, well, what exactly was executed? What is the behavior of the user when they get on to that endpoint? And what we've done in our platform is brought all those data streams together and made them available so that you can correlate all of that information from a single pane of glass, and you can do a ton of automation behind it. So as an example, kind of going with this John Smith example, if we saw an alert, a GeoIP-based alert for John Smith, the first thing that we're going to do is instrument our endpoint agent to go fetch the processes that were run post-logon. And that gives us all of that information in a single pane of glass so that our threat analyst can make very, very quick decisions as to what is legitimate activity and what is not.
One bit of feedback I consistently get is that most organizations aren't ready to actually have a hunt team, or they're not ready for the IDR capabilities that a hunt team would use. Do you think that still applies, or are people catching up? Because it sort of seems like the software market is getting ahead of the actual users here a little bit. I mean, which is often the case, but are they catching up?
I'd say to a certain extent, yes, they're catching up, probably not as quickly as myself or organizations would like. But I think that onus then comes back to the software vendors. So one of the aspects of Inside IDR and the analytic response service that I run here for Rapid7 is that we have a ton of lessons learned coming out of our SOC team, our analysts, and we have a constant feedback loop into the product organization. So one of the things that we're working on right now is the concept of guided hunts, or as our product marketing people like to say it, you know, do it with us. We're not just selling you a product, we're selling you a product, we're selling you a capability, and we're also building in workflow and making the user experience for the tool be a little bit more like training than just using a tool. And what we've decided there is that a lot of the customers that buy into the concept of user insight or Inside IDR don't necessarily have the expertise that we have, so they're not using the full capabilities of the tool. And that's how we're going to be bridging that knowledge gap, is building in those workflows, helping our customers understand how to hunt by providing, you know, wizard-based workflows and tooltips and videos within the product itself.
It seems like the first iteration of this hunt stuff was network-based. So you had your packet loops, you had your net witness. You also had things like Splunk. And of course, the problem with a lot of this tech is that no one really knew how to use it, right? So I think, you know, going to the host makes a lot of sense. But this is a market segment that's become very crowded very quickly. You would acknowledge that, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, just like any other hot industry, a bunch of people are going to be jumping on it. And, you know, for me, that actually really complicates things from the consumer perspective, because an uneducated consumer going shopping for a tool that they don't necessarily understand may be making bad decisions. So a lot of the stuff that we do here at Rapid7, whether it be, you know, our involvement with your podcast or our community site or our Whiteboard Wednesdays, is trying to help educate the industry as to what they need. Now, it may not be that a customer or a prospect needs Rapid7 tools specifically, but we do want the industry to start making better decisions about where they invest specifically in technology.
Yeah, I mean, how much variation is there among these clients? Because I've heard mixed reviews about, you know, there's companies out there who make really good products in one area and their IDR stuff just apparently sucks, right? So what should people, in your view, actually be looking for when it comes to IDR software?
Wow, that's a really loaded question. One of the things that I recommend for any customer is engage with a reputable firm to help you make that determination. So, you know, again, I'm trying to take off my marketing hat and put on my industry advocate hat. But customers should really engage with organizations that offer some IDR program development assistance, where they can the organization or the vendor can come in and perform an evaluation of where the customer stands today, from a people, process, and technology perspective, because every organization is going to be a little bit different. you know, maybe ABC company is going to be a great fit for Inside IDR, whereby, you know, XYZ company might be a better fit for a competition. It's really all based on what you are charged with protecting, the likelihood of you being targeted by an attacker, and the amount of investment that you've really made in your core security program. So your user authentication authorization, your threat prevention model. So that's really where we try to help customers understand where their blind points are, their blind spots are. We also bring in a lot of threat intelligence. So I'm not talking about indicators of compromise or technical threat intelligence. I'm really talking about an understanding of what the attacker does. And using that information, we help our customers take a threat-based approach to building their IDR programs. And that really helps make sure that you are not wasting money on technology investments or people investment or process investments that may not be effective for your particular situation or your particular organization.
So why don't you walk us through what a typical response scenario actually looks like once you've got your IDR ducks in a row? Because I can imagine if you got the right team, you got the right software, you got the right expertise, it's going to be a pretty useful tool. But how is it actually used in a real world scenario?
Sure, absolutely. Now, one of the things that keeps on getting forgotten, and I think this is really by nature of the way the products were marketed in the last decade. So we used to have these magic boxes that would solve all your problems without having to invest people, and we've figured out that that doesn't really work. So when we talk to customers about kind of what happens after you've actually detected a threat, we start with validation, because you can't just rely on a piece of detection technology to tell you 100% whether the threat is real or not, especially when you're talking about attackers impersonating administrators. It's very difficult to get very high fidelity alerting out of behavior analytics. So the first thing that we talk about is being able to validate. Now, validation for us means usually one of two things. Can you get to the endpoint to see what binaries have been executed, what changes happened within the Windows registry or the file system, and so on and so forth? And then the other aspect is being able to go back on the network side of things. So we don't always recommend that our customers have full packet captures, but at the very least, be able to capture some of the packets that follow a particular alert so that your threat analysts have a chance of validating good versus bad, being able to determine true positive versus false positive. And then from there, being able to move into incident response. And incident response for us is very tightly tied with the validation process, because once you have validated a true positive, you need to be able to see where else that particular indicator occurs within your environment. You need to be able to determine if the attacker is using a set of credentials, a set of valid credentials, and you need to be able to scope where those credentials were used within your environment. And the important part about the scoping aspect of the IDR triangle is really being able to effectively understand where the attacker has gone within your environment, what methods for remote access into your environment they have, and then from there you'll be able to move into a containment and remediation strategy, and then typically implement a remediation weekend is what we typically call it, where you disconnect the entire organization from the internet, thus removing any remote access that the attacker has, so that you can really take your time and do the containment properly, remove the affected systems, reset the administrator accounts, and implement monitoring for the indicators of compromise that you identified as part of your investigation.
Well, it's nice that at least these days we're at the point where we got tools to help with that process, because it used to be a grim old experience. Those weekends used to be fueled by a lot of caffeine. Maybe a little less caffeine these days.
Indeed, indeed.
All right, Wade Woolwine, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a bit of a chat about IDR.
Pat, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
That was Wade Woolwine of Rapid7 there, rounding out this week's edition of Risky Business, recorded and produced in Las Vegas. I will be back on deck next week from Australia. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks a bunch for listening.